It's a pleasure and honor for me to introduce our speaker now, Dr. Li Guilin. As you know, he's the president of the society. He's also the president of ACTIC. And I've known her for many years. I think she needs no introduction. We all know her. She has been working in this field for many, many years and has done a lot of work on it. Now, but today is very special because usually it's not life. Today is life. And then, you know, I've always heard Dr. Ling lectures very professionally in either overall or in a suit. Today she's dressed very relaxed, and I tell you, when she is dressed relaxed, she sticks the best. So I think you are fortunate, alright? That's probably very appropriate to me. The future infection control, challenges and opportunities. And I should add that Dr. Ling, very casually, will be addressing this in her bed. Dr. Ling, on your
Prof. Vito, for those kind words. A very good afternoon to all of you. You know, even as we talk about infection control, I believe we really need to also bear in mind the subject of quality. Because we're really living in a very exciting period, and, you know, quality is something that is around us, and it's something that hits us in our history. And even as I show you this roadmap, you know, of how things have developed in infection control in Singapore, it's exciting to note that from the last time I showed you 2 years back and now, you know, we've had our conference, a very successful one 2 years ago, and even more successful one as I can see in this room today. But it's hard, isn't it, to manage and telling people what to do when you don't even know what is this organism you are dealing with. Well, we remembered SARS because we've gone through it and we've lost, unfortunately, some of our loved ones through that episode. And we are aware of avian influenza in this region. It's still going on. And definitely dengue. Oh, sorry. But why are we seeing this? And I'll say the factors could be, well, is it because we have lapses in our infection control? Because, yeah, when you think about it, all you need is a single lapse in infection control. Somebody doesn't wash the hands, and you have transmission, and that's all you need. We must admit we're not perfect. We are a pretty diverse society, aren't we? We've come from various countries. And, yes, I mean, our hand hygiene compliance isn't that great. We're not even there in 80%. We might be in 20 in some country and 60%. But yes, yeah, there may be lapses. Or as one of the authors described in his title, is the world flat? And I must say, if we review in terms of what happened previously, it's probably, you know, all multifactorial. The world is flat. You know, these days, traveling is so easy, isn't it? To me, it's, you really don't have to think much because of all the safety and so forth. It's just like taking a bus. You hop onto the plane and in a few hours, you're in a different country and you can easily deplane and carry on with your work. So, yes, the world is flat. We are able to commute very easily and so do bugs. But it doesn't help to be aware that our infection control practices aren't that great in many of our healthcare institutions, despite the fact that we are living in an era where quality in healthcare is so much emphasized and promoted. There's the subject of MDROs, and we've heard a lot during this conference, even this morning, and I'd like to bring your attention to the new Delhi metallobacter lactamase, which has hit the news when it came out in the newspaper, in the journals, and this, even I quote this article from the Lancet Infectious Disease, to kind of, you know, pictorially tell us it's not just New Delhi, you know, where you could see this organism. It's also in UK, in several parts, in Bangladesh and Pakistan, and as if you heard earlier on, it's also in other parts of the world, whether it's Japan, Australia, and we've also seen it in Singapore in this breaking news in September last year. And if you carefully look at what is reported, how did we find this? And like most cases, when somebody discovered something, usually in Singapore, what we do is that we look through our records. And what we've done in the microbiology laboratory, you know, we keep lots of isolates. We love keeping interesting isolates. And these are interesting isolates because they are multi-resistant. Nobody has ever identified them. And so we ran through the tests, and the microbiologists in our laboratory discovered, hey, we do have the MDM, and it was much earlier in the year 2010. So that hit the news, and it was called a new superbug that is found on our shore. But shortly, within a month, there were more and more cases. And we are also seeing this in our hospitals. And it causes a lot of interest, created a lot of interest, not just amongst our infection control professionals, but also amongst our administrators. And the question arose, should we be screening for NDM1? I think it would be wonderful if we could screen it, because if you look at the successes we had with MRSA and so forth, if we are able to screen, then we would know what to do. But the problem is, up to this date, we have yet to find a good screening tool. So the problem still exists. There are NDM cases amongst us, and with it being a new organism and not too much being understood, it is a challenge to us. What about other MDROs? MRSA is a good example to look at. And here there's this nice pictorial graph in terms of, you know, on the world map, what is the prevalence of MRSA in the world? Now, if you look where Singapore is, well, we fall in the category of more than 50%, just like Hong Kong and Malta. Okay, and Grundman in his article in Lancet estimated that there are about 2 to 53 million MRSA carriers in the world. Now, that's a lot, don't you think so? So many MRSA carriers, and they could just be beside you. Okay, and they're around the world. And in terms of ESBL, although this may be an old article reported in a Diagnostic Microbiology Infectious Disease Journal in 2005, and you look at Singapore, we did have a fair number. I would say the problem still continues, because when we looked at our recent data, looking just at, over a time period from 2006 to first half of 2010, we did see a rise in our incidence for ceftriaxone-resistant Escherichia coli. And that's a concern. You know, why are we seeing a steady increase in this possible ESBL among Enterobacteriaceae? And not different, but even more alarming, I would say, it will be in terms of the carbapenem-resistant strains amongst our Enterobacteriaceae. We saw a big rise recently, and it's a concern. So it's not just MRSA VR, but we need to be concerned about our gram-negative, as was discussed earlier on even in this conference. So they are with us, and unfortunately, they do give us headaches as infection control professionals in terms of clusters and outbreaks, and they have a habit of occurring at interesting times. And in my department, we have this interesting comment that we usually see these problems on a Friday afternoon. You know, just when you're about to go off for your weekend, you know, or you know, maybe for your holiday, you know, the news came up, look, I think I have a cluster, we need to look into it, you know. And like what somebody described earlier on this conference, it seems to occur, at least in our country, during spring, you know, in February, March, April, I'm not sure why. But we do see outbreaks occurring, whether it be MRSA, VRE, the gram-negative, and so forth. But we are also aware that there are efforts going on in terms of controlling our MDROs. And I show you here the incidence for nosocomial MRSA infections in Singapore. And this is data gathered from our various public acute care hospitals. And you can see there is a nice decline, and especially so in the last couple of years. Why is this so? It's because there is an active program across the country against the MRSA. And this basically focuses mainly on the arm of active surveillance in the MRSA bundle. And by this we mean we would either be universally screening every admission for MRSA, or risk stratify our population group and screen them for MRSA, and whether they are inpatients or, you know, patients coming in for elective surgery. And it's just like this iceberg you see in the picture, you know. if we just depend on clinical cultures, we're going to miss a lot. But if we really screen everybody, then we should be able to pick up a problem quite easily and then do the right things. And this is a success story that I'd like to share with you in the hospital where I work in. It's a 1,600-bed acute care hospital. And for a long time, we've been, you know, dealing with our MRSA problem when it hit us from the time in 1985 when it came to our shore. And as you've seen earlier on, we had more than 50% of our staph aureus strains being MRSA. So for a long time, you know, people say we are endemic. And then, you know, when you begin to say that, there's a danger of becoming complacent, that you want to live with the problem. You know, since you can't get rid of it, then we might as well live with it. But that has changed, again, because of the quality movement. Because we no longer talk about, you know, endemicity, but instead, the vocabulary has changed. We should be aiming for zero healthcare-associated infections. And so we started active surveillance late 2007, and by 2008, through gradual implementation over phases, we were able to screen high-risk patient groups in our hospital for MRSA, and at the same time, you know, while knowing that they are MRSA carriers, appropriately institute the measures. And so as you could see, we had a remarkable declination in our kind of rates from 0.6 to 0.3 per thousand patient days. So that's our success story. We were able to reduce something which we call endemic. This is a picture which I took while I was on holiday in Japan recently. And I was on board that ship. Okay, this is not an iceberg. If it is an iceberg, I won't be here standing in front of you. You know, it's like the Titanic story. When you hit an iceberg, the whole ship will capsize. But rather, you know, the truth is, this is a drift ice. See, what happens is, this picture was taken in Hokkaido, and I was on board on this ship, and this ship was actually just sailing through the sea, and we were cutting through the drift ice. Drift ice is actually, well, not so thick like an iceberg. What happens is that you have ice, the water in the sea would kind of freeze, right? And then you will have these great chunks coming down from Russia and the northern part of China, and it would drift down to Japan. And so, this, in fact, when you looked at the whole sea, you see this whole area covered, you know, with what looked like ice and so forth. So, what I'd like to bring forward is this. Yes, we do have an MDRO issue. It looks phenomenal when we look at our rates. And even as we think in terms of our attempt, you know, sometimes encouraging when we see like we have success stories like others. But some of us have very disappointing moments when we looked at how other people do and we are not able to do it. But the thing is, to be able to have a good perspective of our problem, is it really an iceberg that really we shouldn't be kind of, you know, banging again our ship against it? Or is it a drift ice? Because if it's a drift ice, when the ship kind of hits it, it just breaks the ice. And then you can go on with your path. And so I would say challenge number one for us infection control at this time in this region is this, that we should be looking at our MDRO seriously because it is a big issue, not just the MRSA and the gram-negatives, every one of them. And then think of how we can creatively, you know, strategize to reduce our MDROs to near zero. We admit that we can't be at zero, but we should aim at least near zero because look at that, how people have done just doing MRSA reduction and try and reduce this at least in our healthcare hospitals and ILTCs. And once we've done that, you know, we should be able to see progress moving on. And for Singapore, we've done that, right, in our various acute care hospitals. And I'll say, you know, we should continue our good work with the ILTCs. So work has begun. And like I said earlier on, let's not be discouraged, although there are many issues we have not talked about, you know, whether it's a consent issue, the legal issues, the ethical issues, how should we screen, how many sites and so forth. Because in infection control, we never give up, do we? If we have given up practicing as infection control, I think many of us won't be practicing anymore. All right, because the daily issues that we deal with, you know, it's very challenging, not easy. But we always persist on and we will try our various ways to get around it. So let's not give up. No? The challenge is let's try and deal with our MDROs, the successes we've seen with our healthcare associate MRSA, let's translate that to other MDROs that we see in our facility. Well, recently we've seen very interesting outbreaks, not just MDROs, and I remembered more than a year ago, you know, the microbiology laboratory began reporting bacillus species in blood cultures and so forth. You know, as you can see, you know, usually we ignore such things. We think it's contaminant. But when someone pulls out the data and looks at it and suddenly see, why are we seeing too many bacillus species? Is it because people are not cleaning the site properly? But no. And so we saw this not just happening in one institution, but in various institutions across our country. And so when we got together and, you know, to cut the long story short, we were able to pinpoint the problem to powdered gloves. Okay, these were gloves, non-sterile gloves that people use. Somehow, this is interesting, you shouldn't be using non-sterile gloves, but somehow some people were using non-sterile gloves and they were powdered. And the powder, when we culture it, were bacillus species. And so that's how we put the two together. And since that day, we were able to kind of stop this problem by, you know, just sharing that we shouldn't be doing this, one thing, that's the wrong practice. And secondly, let's move away from the use of powdered gloves. So now we're using a non-powdered gloves in our clinical area. So that stopped the problem. And then late last year, we had an interesting problem with oral mouthwash that's contaminated with Burkholderia sepacea and body wipes. And those of you in the conference, you can see there's an interesting poster out there talking about this particular problem in one of our local hospitals. So this was an issue that we faced as a country, because it didn't occur in just one hospital, but in all the hospitals, gradually picking up issues of patients having Burkholderia sepacea being colonized in their nasal aspirates, you know, and the ETT tube aspirates and sputum and the wounds and so forth. So much so that when we were able to track down what was the problem, we worked quickly with HSA and make sure the products were withdrawn. There were other literature studies in terms of contamination, and when we glean through the literature, it's telling us something, that the environment is not clean. But surely, you know, this is something we already know. We surely don't live in a sterile bubble, right? And when patients are within the hospital environment, naturally, you know, they will contaminate the environment, whether it's MRSA, VRE, or C. difficile. And so you can see in this nice tabulation table, in terms of what is the contamination rate like for the various surfaces. It's really everywhere, including your BP cuffs, your patient's table, the bed sheets, and so forth. And why is this happening? Because in reality, there are many, many high touch points in our patient care, right? If you can, you can take a video picture, you know, in terms of what goes on in the clinical area, the healthcare worker actually touches many, many points, whether it's the monitors, whether it's making sure patients are all right and so forth. And so we do transmit organisms from a patient who's colonized to his environment and so forth. And there's a nice review in this paper which explains that, you know, nosocomial pathogens that exist in the hospital environment do stay there for a pretty long time. And if you scan through this list, it's really kind of shocking to see that it could stay there for months. But then you say, I thought we cleaned the hospital environment. We have cleaners. Yes, they do clean. But there's a challenge. How clean is clean? And this nice paper by Martinez showed that basically that when you have a patient in a room, he does shed the organism in his environment. It's heavily contaminated where he is in terms of bed linen, bed rails, tabletops, and so forth. And that's the same principle, be whichever MDRO, be it MRSA, VRE, or even C. diff. And I think C. diff is a real problem because it's a sporulating organism, difficult to kill with disinfectants. But marrying the two, understanding that these organisms can be in the inanimate environment for some time and just waiting for a healthcare worker to come by, pick up and transfer to another patient. And in that paper, they described how they were able to show, you know, a new patient who comes into an empty room, which was previously occupied by someone who had, say, a VRE, this new patient was able to quickly, you know, be colonized with that particular VRE. And so you have the beginning of that transmission and gradually an outbreak if you are quick enough to kind of pick it up. So there are challenges. And because surfaces are contaminated, and we, as long as you have a patient who is a carrier, or even he has left the scene, he's left trails behind, we've got healthcare workers who are supposed to clean their hands, but unfortunately our hand hygiene compliance aren't great. Most of the time it's less than 50%. And so the stage is set, isn't it, in terms of transmission. So in this particular paper by Carling in AJIC 2006, you know, the findings that they've had really, you know, should make us sit up in our seats. And in this particular study, what they've done is really looking at practices in three different hospitals and studying in terms of environmental cultures. How well do your housekeeping staff clean their rooms? And the truth is, it's only 50% of the time. Because 50% of the time, if you go back and check at it, it's not 100% clean. You still can find some spots which are contaminated. Is this true? If you don't believe it, check your area. And that's what we did. We did check our area. We ran a quality improvement project in our unit, and we did this with our housekeeping staff. What we did was this. Okay, the house cleaning staff is supposed to clean the area, right? And what my infection control nurse does is that before the housekeeping staff clean, she would have secretly dusted this magic powder, you know, the ones that you use called Glow Gem for hand hygiene compliance practice check. Yeah, we sprinkle some of this magic dust, all right, around the hospital area. And so as the housekeeping staff did their routine cleaning, then later we'll come by, you know, use the UV torch, shine over it, and then check, is it thoroughly clean? And of course, as you can see, you know, some areas are not thoroughly clean. And we were able to use this as a teaching tool to our housekeeping staff just to highlight to them, there are certain areas that you should be focusing on. You know, and these are important because we really are all on the way out to try and prevent outbreaks due to contaminated environment. So I would say challenge number two is knowing that we are in this soup of MDROs around us and inefficient practices in terms of infection control. The challenge is how do we have clean and safe environment and equipment, like what I've described earlier on, whatever things that you use on the patient and so forth. And what we can do, and this is something if we have not already been involved, is to volunteer ourselves and say we would like to be involved in product selection, you know, help us include us in our evaluation of products for use and so forth. And so this is where more and more of us are getting into partnership with our materials management and, you know, biomedical people. You know, we want to be involved with whatever your product selection involved, because we want to ensure that the environment should be kept clean and safe. Otherwise, we have more outbreaks. We do need to break the chain of infection, don't we? That's something we always teach in our basics for infection control. Because if we can break that chain, then there's no way anything could be transmitted. And so we rely very much on guidelines, what people have done from their evidence-based studies, translated into evidence-based guidelines and practices. And so we are fully aware of contact precautions. The purpose is, well, we just want to reduce the risk of transmission of what we call epidemiologically important microorganisms, which are spread by contact directly or indirectly. And we're talking about organisms like the MDROs, the Clostridium difficile, and of course, any gastroenteritis pathogens. So that is the sole purpose of implementing contact precautions. And here I show you a picture in terms of what we do in our hospital. We have signages, you know, to say, you know, to remind people you must do this, put on your gown and gloves as you go in, because this patient has MDRO, we want to break the transmission, everybody should be cleaning their hands, they should be housed properly, and when you transport this patient, there are certain do's and don'ts and so forth. And housekeeping, you need to be careful and so forth. And we try our very best to prepare patients in single room or in cohorted area. The question is, you know, do we really need to apply contact precautions all the time? Really, really all the time? And, you know, like all infection control believers, right, we say, yeah, of course, definitely. Otherwise, you know, what do our previous guidelines talk about? Yes, because that's the only way we want to prevent transmission. No, but yes, there's also a no to this question, because people are beginning to find out there are issues when you put people in single rooms, right? There are issues in terms of, well, they found that there are less patient healthcare worker contact. You know, we try our very best not to go into that room with that special signage because you have to put on gown and gloves and so forth. And so it does, unfortunately, impact patient care. And as you can see in this Kirkland and Weinstein study, they showed that, you know, you have half the type of patient contact compared to someone who's not put on contact precautions. And, well, healthcare workers are more likely to wash hands. That's good, you know, when they see the signs. But then they should be washing their hands all the time, isn't it? Because we don't screen for all kinds of MDROs. That's an issue. And attending physicians, less likely to examine patients on contact precautions. That's not good news. Huh? They tend to touch them less. And that can in really affect patient care and therefore not good quality care. Spending less time with patients and so also not very, you know, it doesn't go well, you know, in terms of the message. Well, we should be delivering quality health care in this generation. But there are issues. You know, the sign is there. We have to go through this ritual of putting on gown and gloves, and it's not easy. You know, I got a special way of tying your strings at the back and not the front and so forth, and how you should de-glove and so forth. So it takes time. Single rooms we try, but we do not have enough single rooms. So can we get away with that? Yes, we maybe we can. We can cohort them in certain rooms. And I'm sure many of us echo the same message. We try very hard, right? We try to put people cohorted in a single cubicle. But then I think there are some of you who are nurse managers here who manage your own ward. You understand, right? You might initially be able successful to try and cohort them. But as you have patients coming in and leaving, it's just impossible. Because you have no time to play musical chairs, transferring a patient from one area to another just to make sure this is a cohorted area. So the truth is, in real life, it doesn't really happen. And it's a real challenge for us, in especially in this part of the world, where we do not have the luxury of single rooms in our healthcare institution. Many of us still have the Florence Nightingale type of wards, huh? Or, you know, cubicles where we have 10 patients in one cubicle and so forth, sharing toilet facilities and so forth. And I bring you to this interesting article in AGIC, published in 2005, just looking at human behavior. This is in Iran. And what they did was just a simple questionnaire survey amongst 270 nurses, midwives, and auxiliary nurses, asking them what you know about contact precautions, what you think about it, and then checking whether they're really doing what they believe they say should be about contact precautions. And so you can see the results. And there's a big difference between knowledge and between practice. Practice definitely lags far, far behind. You might say, yes, I need to glove on entry and remove gloves, but, you know, 50% of the time, actually, I don't do it. The truth is that, right? Then there's another study in AJIC 2007 and said, you know, maybe it's quite complicating, you know, gown and gloves. What if we take away the gown, you know, and just say everybody puts on gloves, all right? And after all, that's quite easy, right? Just put on gloves. And then let's see, could we be able to kind of reduce the transmission of our MDROs? But look at the results. Okay, the first phase is the usual gloves and gowns for contact precautions. And the second phase is just put on gloves. And you can see that they do get very high compliance, and you know, from 75% to 87%. So that's improvement in terms of performance and compliance. And in terms of are they able to prevent transmission? What do you see? It's a negative. Instead, they had another problem. It didn't get better. Instead, it got worse, and I'm sure you can understand very quickly why is that so. Because when someone puts gloves all the time, who are you protecting? It's yourself, right? And you tend not to remove the gloves. With the same pair of gloves, you would answer phone calls, open doorknobs, and so forth. And so you are really adding to the transmission. So you do get undesirable outcome, you know, just with having that practice. So there must be better ways of implementing, you know, contact precautions. And our experience, you know, when we looked in terms of how people are complying to contact precautions, it's the same. Half the time, people are not doing it, despite the fact that this is nice signage or a sticker on the wall and so forth. And if you talk about visitors, it's even worse. You know, it's, you know, 10 times less in terms of the compliance. So when we did our audit, it's only 5% that a visitor would, you know, put on the gown and gloves, go in and talk to the patient and so forth. They just don't do it. Okay? So, and when you ask people, why is it that you don't put on gown and gloves? And these are interesting remarks people say. But I'm not touching the patient. I'm just going in, saying hello to him, answering his questions, you know, because he pressed the call bell. Or I'm only serving him food in a tray. I don't touch anything. You know, I put our tray on his table and off I go. Or, you know, and things like that. But is that the truth? Because in real life, yes, I might go in with that intent. But then there are things happening, even in that few seconds or minutes, right? That someone else might ask you something, you would tend to another patient and so forth. So yes, there are issues. And I would say the challenge number three is, you know, yeah, we have MDROs, we know what to do and so forth, but for contact precautions, I would say we need to get real in terms of how can we ensure that our people would apply these precautions in the right way. And how to ensure that at least get them to comply more than 90% of the time. Were we able to do it? Think of SARS. We were able to do it, isn't it? In fact, I would say it's close to 100%. And why do people do it? Because they don't want to get it, right? But then when we talk about MRSA, nobody bothers whether they acquire MRSA on themselves, you know, and things like that. But there are really practical issues, honestly, on the ground as to why our people are not putting on contact precautions to the way it should be practiced. And so the challenge is, how do we get our healthcare workers to achieve more than 90% compliance? Now, I'll say what we can do is this. We should find ways to make it easier for them to do it right all the time, isn't it? Because it's really their intent, never their intent to transmit bacteria. You know, they just want to do good work, attend the patient. So what can we do? And I would say, let's try and focus on hand hygiene. If we are able to focus on hand hygiene, and this is the same message that WHO has been talking about, if we can get people to just use alcohol hand rub, you know, and practice the 5 moments and get our hand hygiene compliance more than 80%, I would say we're almost near there in terms of preventing that transmission. So the crucial thing is break that transmission cycle, but doing it in the most practical manner and feasible manner for everyone. Patients and visitors are the ones who come down with healthcare-associated infections. And so when we think about, it would make sense if we involve them in our program, wouldn't it? And if you look at your own program and my program, most of the time we are talking about educating staff, okay, making sure they understand what's MDRO, what are the various precautions. But what about educating and involving our patient? And this is something which the quality movement has been talking about, patient engagement, patient partnership. And you would have seen the fantastic results that they've had, even for the medication error and so forth, that when you involve the patient, you know, it's such a powerful manner to get the program going and to ensure that things get done. So we should be paying attention to our patient education program, whether it's by giving out flyers and telling them about how we do infection control, talking about hand hygiene. And we did try this in our hand hygiene program at our hospital to get people to wear badges. And on the badge it says, ask me if I've cleaned my hands. Perhaps you could guess how successful that is. And I was quite amused when I think back of our results. The truth is that it wasn't very successful. Okay, people can tell me various reasons. I don't like to wear that badge, or I have too many things on my uniform. There's no space for that badge. But whatever it is, I think we feel very threatened, isn't it? What if the patient really asks you, have you cleaned your hands? Although we would say, well, the patients won't dare to ask me. But the point is, I think we have to get over that hurdle. And we've heard earlier on in our hand hygiene symposium discussion earlier on how, you know, when we are able to highlight the importance and get patient awareness and understanding, it actually goes a long way. And so we should be looking at our program, how to involve more and more of our patient. And so that's the challenge number four, to develop effective partnership with our patients and family and their families. Okay, and not just focus our program amongst our healthcare workers and so forth. What we can do, get them involved, you know, whether it's in terms of focus group discussion, what's the best way working for them, you know, or, you know, and there are all kinds of strategies for informing, educating and involving patients, and you could find that tons of it in the literature. Another area is in the area of training, and this has been, always been a subject of interest for me because I do enjoy training, and we've invested quite a number of time and effort in this, and Asia-Pacific Society of Infection Control has piloted this, and it's now such a successful program in this region that this course is run in several countries, in Hong Kong, in Malaysia, and even in Singapore. For us, we do it once in 2 years. And it's through this education program that we were able to kind of teach masses of people and to make sure that they're adequately trained. And I'm talking about people who do infection control. You know, this is a very comprehensive program, 8.5 days with an exam. Okay, then and they also get visits to a hospital and so forth. So they really do learn a lot. And I want to kind of share with you a vision which I have, and that is this. Isn't as I read through what other people have done, and I thought the Koreans did something very interesting. They were also into training, and what they've done in Korea, which is reported in this AJIC 2010 article, is that they are building a curriculum for training in a tertiary center in terms of, you know, making sure that they have an infection control curriculum in a graduate school. So it's a master's program that they are offering. Master's program for registered nurses with bachelor's degree or higher, more than 3 years. And you look at the things that they're learning. It kind of in-depth, you know, studies of the various important aspects for infection control. And this is something that is not, I would say, readily available in most parts of the world. Why I say this is because even as we were scouting through the internet trying to find where can I send my infection control nurse overseas for master's training, very, very few. Okay, very hard to find. And so the point is, I think those of us, especially if we are working in kind of universities and so on, if we are able to kind of put up some program like this, I think it will go a long way. Because if we are able to equip our infection control professional in a kind of robust way, I'm sure they could do far more work. Why I say this? Because even through the APSIC program, when we kind of push that program through this region, we've had many encouraging comments from people who've gone through that short program. They have gone back to their countries, implemented, and seen wonderful cost-effective results, you know, and they are very thrilled with that, and that's how infection control program grow. But if we are able to offer something like this, a master program, I think that would really help. And after all, you know, it's a paper, and it's a recognized paper. So I'm not sure, you know, but all I can say that papers do matter these days, don't they? Sometimes a little cert that you've attended a course doesn't pay much attention. It doesn't get recognized. You don't get promoted, you know, you don't get extra pay and so forth. But to get a paper which says you have a master's, that's really important. What I'm trying to aim at is that we do need recognition amongst our infection control professional folks. And the challenge is, you know, as we have seen in the earlier discussion, the roles of the ICP is changing. No, gone are the days, you know, where you just do simple surveillance, simple teaching amongst your healthcare workers. It's more than that. There are issues on the ground. There are issues in terms of managing senior people, you know, helping to show them we do need to do this active surveillance, and this is the kind of cost-effective measure. This is the economics and so forth. So you do need to know something about management, about economics and so forth. You do need to know something about engineering, because there are issues related to construction, renovation, and then plus all those products that I kind of highlighted to you. They might be new. I mean, we don't know much about chemicals and things and equipment, but there are issues with the use of these on our patients, and we need to know, understand a little bit about this. We need to know how to educate. And no longer are the, can we use like what we used in the past, prepare some slides, give a lecture, and everybody listens and believes, and they do. They don't. Why? Because we are living in a different generation, right? I'm not sure what you call the generation now, but what is it? It's not Y, is it?
Y.
Yeah, but basically, it's different. We have to use adult-based learning. People are not willing to sit down and listen to didactic lectures. They want to know why, and so you have to engage them. And so this is something, it's a challenging thing for all of us as infection control professionals. If we want our program to be really successful, we must look at ways and how we can expand, our role, and not just expand, but be equipped for that role. And so I would say the challenge number five is, yes, we do need ICPs. They're never enough. We do need train ICPs, so we try, but we do need to really train them professionally well so that we do have adequate numbers of able infection control professionals who can do good work on a day-to-day basis, do good research, publish papers, gather evidence and so forth, so that we can convince our leaders and so forth. What can we do? Train, never ends. But train in a very effective manner to people who need the training. So, in conclusion, I would say the MDROs around us, they do remind us that our infection control programs need upgrading. And this is a picture taken from Kyoto. It's actually, if you look at buildings, it's very strange. You don't see five pillars, but this one has five pillars. And usually you see even numbers, right? Four, but five pillars. And I thought it was fascinating. And it's just like the five challenges I told you about. We do need upgrading. Yes, we may have a whole list in terms of what infection control program should look like, but in terms of implementation, let's be aware where we are right now. There are many challenges, and there are creative ways of solving it. And so I would say the five pillars need strengthening. Or if you haven't done any work, do something about it. The MDRO in your hospital, do you know how big is that problem? And there are good tools on the website, and I would like to introduce you to the MDRO toolkit that is available on the Joint Commission website. It's fantastic if you just look at that toolkit in terms of how you can assess the burden in your institution and decide, what can I do, with this situation? And the second pillar is in the area of equipment and environment safety. Let's not forget that issue. Okay, we might be focusing a lot of attention on practices, but let's not forget this very important issue of keeping the environment clean. And this is where we need to work partnership with our people, housekeeping, the support services and so forth. We do need practical contact precautions, and I would like to all of us to kind of review what we have and come up with adaptive guidelines for wherever we come from so that our people can practice this in a practical manner. We do need more patient involvement in infection control. And last but not least, train ICPs. Every challenge is really an opportunity. It's just like when you travel down a winding road, right? It's a challenge. You never know what's going to lie in store as you go around the bend. But if you go around the bend, you're going to see something different, right? And it might be something good, it might not be something good, but wherever it is, it's an ongoing journey that we have. And as ICPs, I would like to end on this encouraging note. Although there are many, many challenges, but it's not the end of the world. We can meet these challenges, and it's a matter of how we perceive it. If we perceive it as an opportunity for us to grapple with and move on, we can look forward to a better tomorrow. Thank you.
Sometimes it's just like, See, wait, the rule. We found Singapore.
Not in Singapore, sorry.
See, what is your present MRI rate now? And your chart shows 0.3.
That's right, 0.3 per 1,000 patients. And that's in terms of healthcare-associated MRSA infections. You know, it's come down a lot, you know, with that program.
You compared to the UK data, it's still kind of high.
Well, we started high, but to be able to break it down 50%, I think that's remarkable in 2-year period.
One more thing is that you mentioned about the environment, which is very important. How much of these new machines, this fumigating movement,
Well, it hasn't quite hit us because they are expensive machines. And, you know, I think for us, we've gone past the era of fumigation, right? We've actually said it is an obsolete measure as well, so we don't do it. So when these new machines come, you know, we're a bit skeptical at first. But then there are lots of interesting data in the literature, and I must say it's promising. And especially from our own experience, where we try as best as we can, clean and clean and clean, check and check and check, but you cannot reach 100%. You know, and so I think it's very frustrating, and those figures are promising. And so what we've done is to embark on studies. So, and we're still in the midst of our study, and I could only tell you the result in a year's time. What's our experience going to be like?
Thank you, everybody. We'll end here, and thank you very much.
Thank you.